A very special guest joins us in this edition of the podcast, namely Jonathan Brent. Special because of his very significant achievements, but also because he's somebody I've known for many years. And you know, Jonathan, it's kind of hard to conduct a formal interview when you're talking to an old friend. So I'll say hello and ask you, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. It's great to talk to you again, Milt. I look forward to the conversation.
Now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make you a proposition. Ob du willst, man kann jetzt reden nur in Emesse Marmeloschen. Für die ganze Stunde. Wo sagst du?
Well, we're not going to get too far if we have to conduct this in Yiddish, I can tell you that.
How's my Yiddish?
Yiddish is good. Yiddish is, despite all of the terrible prophecies, it is continuing to be a spoken language. It's being taught in universities. The interesting thing that we're discovering is that it is being taught in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Lithuania, Russia, Ukraine, and Germany. And so it's coming back in some way as a language, and not only among the Hasidim.
My problem is I don't have anybody to speak it to. It was truly my Marmeloschen. That is, my parents tell me it was my first language. Though obviously I went into some state of decay or decrepitude in my later life. And I don't ordinarily have any occasion to use it, except for the rare occasion when here in Chicago and on Devon Avenue, I might run into an Emes HaChassid, a true Hasidic Jew, who speaks Yiddish, that I will exchange a few words with some special pleasure, because it's a language in my repertoire, though it's frayed by now, but one that I just really don't get a chance to exercise. How well do you speak it, and how did you come by it?
Well, to be honest, I can understand it and I can read it, but I can't really speak it very well because I never spoke it. At home, my father used to speak it to us, but he never taught the language to us. And then when I was in college, I made an attempt at learning it academically, but it wasn't really being taught at that time, and it wasn't being taught well, so I dropped it and concentrated on Russian.
Now, I should make clear to our listeners why I started in Yiddish. I've just plunged right in without the usual formality. Jonathan Brent is, these days, the executive director of YIVO. Y-I-V-O. He was formerly the editorial director of Yale University Press. Before that, he held a similar post at Northwestern University Press. And before that, he founded and ran an eminent literary magazine. We should talk instantly about YIVO and its mission. It is, of course, an acronym. What is it an acronym for?
It's an acronym for Yiddischer Wissenschaftlicher Institut. The Jewish or Yiddish Scientific Institute.
And its basic task has been from the very beginning to preserve, to gather, to organize, and to celebrate essentially Yiddish East European culture.
That's correct. It was an organization that was founded on Yiddish because Yiddish was the language that was spoken by the majority of Jews in Eastern Europe. But as many of the founders recognized, its reach and its interests went far beyond just the Yiddish-speaking world to German, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, Lithuanian lands.
And one of the entities that Adolf Hitler and his friends killed or came close to killing was the Yiddish language. In that they killed some 6 million Yiddish speakers. Perhaps they weren't all Yiddish speakers. Perhaps some of the Jews towards the end who were shipped in for extermination from France or from Belgium and so on were not competent Yiddish speakers. But most of the exterminated Jews in the Holocaust were, of course, essentially given to the use of Marmeloschen. Marmeloschen, in simple translation, means the mother tongue.
Right. Of course, there were even Poles at that time, and Ukrainians who fancied that they didn't speak Yiddish because they had already achieved a certain degree of of assimilation.
Yeah.
But for the most part, the vast majority of people spoke one or another dialect of Yiddish. Yeah.
Yibo was based in Vilnius or Vilna, once a Polish city, then the capital of Lithuania. And it was founded, I believe, in 1925. Isn't that right?
That's correct, yes.
And by 1940, a problem had emerged which confronted the managers of Yibo, certainly.
Yeah. It was founded in 1925, actually in Berlin. Sigmund Freud and Albert Einstein were honorary members of the board, and the purpose of it was, for the first time in history, to try to write a real history of the 1,000 years of Jewish settlement and life in Eastern Europe and Russia. It had never been done. Nobody actually knew what the Jews had done for this 1,000 years. There were myths, there were stories, there were songs, there were poems, there was this, but no real history of what everyday life looked like for them.
A great historian, and he must have been associated with Yivo, I believe I read that he was Dubnov.
Yes. Well, in a way, Yivo was his brainchild, brainchild, because they're the ones who really began the interest in collecting documents for the purpose of preserving, but also creating a narrative of that life. You know, the very, very famous Anski expedition that was started in 1910 or 1911 and ran to 1914 went all around the Pale of Settlement, collecting stories, poems, amulets, folklore, music, all kinds of things. And Yivo was founded in 1925 basically as a center for this kind of collection effort, the purpose of which was to write that, to train scholars to write a real history.
What was the collection there in Vilnius in 1940? When they faced the great crisis of the oncoming Nazi horde. But what was gathered together in the one great collection at that time, before they had to get out of town?
Well, one of the most absolutely priceless aspects of the collection was the only complete collection of Yiddish literature in the world, from beginning to end. And Yivo had amassed this because they collected everything. And, you know, Yiddish was a language that flourished rather briefly, in fact, from about 1850 to 1930. It didn't have a lot of time. And the consequence of it is that a lot of things that were published never got collected into book form. They remained in pamphlets. And these, of course, were the most perishable and easily disposed of things. And so the Yivo collection was amazing because it had all of the pamphlets. And fortunately, through incredible luck and the paradoxes of history, these materials, to a great extent, were saved by the Nazis. They didn't destroy them. Instead, they shipped them to Frankfurt. And after the war, they came to New York City. So the Yiddish collection remains at the core of certainly what Yivo had in Vilnius. But in addition to Yiddish literature, it had a vast music archive. It had the posters of the Yiddish theater. It had records of the Kehillah. Kehillas throughout Eastern Europe. It had various pinkasim, that is, records of the rabbinical courts. It had all kinds of things that pertain to the daily life of the people, going back to the 15th century.
From what I've been reading on this, the single great collection there in Vilna essentially was subject to a tripartite division. Some stuff got directly to New York, some saved by the Nazis, as I understand it, because they wanted to sort of build a great anti-Jewish museum after the war to justify their historic mission. And that was in Frankfurt. And about a third was left in Vilna. And you've been back to Vilna very often, I gather, trying to get all of that annotated and properly digitalized and rejoined with your vast collection in New York. Do I summarize that correctly?
That's absolutely correct, Milt. That's what happened. The piece that you left out here is that the Nazis destroyed a certain amount of material that they felt was not important enough. And the way that they determined this was very interesting. They had Yiddish and Hebrew speaking experts, trained experts in the Einsatzstab Rosenberg unit that came to Vilnius, and they began the sorting process, but they quickly realized that they couldn't sort all the material because it was so vast. And so they enlisted members of the Evo staff who were in the ghetto to come and sort the material, which they did. And some of the material was thereby hidden by these Evo workers. But another cache of material was simply pulped by the Nazis and destroyed. After the war, when the material that was hidden was recollected by Avram Sutzkever and Shmerke Kaczerginski, what happened was that they put it all together into a new museum that they wanted to build in Vilnius in 1944-45. When the Soviets came in 1946-47, they let that museum live for a little while, but 2 years later, they wanted to destroy all of the material again. So, and they did destroy a certain amount. So we don't really know what was destroyed in these two efforts by the Nazis and the Soviets.
You said that when the Nazis came to Vilnius, the material at YIVO was sorted out by an Einsatz Rosenberg group.
Yes.
I didn't know that. No blood relation of mine, apparently. But Alfred Rosenberg was the official philosopher of the Nazi Party, supposedly.
That's correct. They took a very special interest in YIVO because they knew in advance that this was the organization that would be able to tell the story of the Jews of Eastern Europe, and that was a story that they wanted in some perverse and, I'm sure, perverted fashion to tell in Frankfurt after the war when there were no Jews left.
It seems to me we have to, in this conversation, deal with the ambivalence towards Yiddish, which has persisted. Ambivalence means two-sided affect, negative mm-hmm. and strong positive, but there has been negative. I'll tell you a little quick story. My first visit to Israel many years ago, and I am not a Hebrew speaker, and I was standing on a street corner waiting for somebody to join me for something or other, when I heard the lilt of Yiddish off in the distance before I could make out the words. And as it came, and then two older men approached where I was standing, speaking Yiddish. And the first words of Yiddish that I heard in Israel, I'd only been there in Haifa, actually, for about a day or two. The first words I heard was the one guy saying to the other, "Nu, in Israel eich, men shlok yidden." Well, you see, even in Israel, they beat up Jews, which was a complaint about the government or something. I don't know what. But it's interesting to me that the very first Yiddish words I heard in Israel were echoing complaints about the poor lot of the Jews. And the Israelis themselves, Ben Gurion particularly, as I have read someplace, really wanted to discourage the use of Yiddish because it was the language of the ghetto. It was the language of oppression. It was based in German. And we know how we feel about the Germans. And there was a discouragement of Yiddish in Israel. I know that that's over now, or I guess it's over. But similarly, lots of people in the Western world, it seems to me, who had some Mamaloshian connection to the language, put it aside as quickly as they could as part of the general assimilationist process. I'm just sort of free associating on all of this. But do you agree that there has been a kind of ambivalence, even among many sectors of the Jewish world, towards the Yiddish language itself?
Absolutely. And the Israelis were very clear about it. It was more than just neglect of Yiddish Israel, there was actual intimidation. It was not allowed to be taught in schools. It was actively discouraged in all sorts of ways, such that when Tuvia Bielski, who was the great leader of the Bielski Partisans, and that was the basis of the film Defiance that came out a few years ago, when he wrote his memoir soon after the war, and he was living in Israel, he decided not, and he wrote it in Yiddish, he decided not to give his memoir to Israel, to the National Library. Instead, he came to the United States and he deposited it with YIVO. And so there was a great deal of, not, I would say not even ambivalence, just really disdain and dislike, and in some cases hatred of the language, because, as you say quite rightly, it represented the degradation of the Jewish people in Eastern Europe, with connotations of the war, and moreover with passivity, with victimization, and with all of those things that the state of Israel wanted to forget about. Today, and, go ahead.
I was just wondering, and what would you add about the attitudes of American Jews, not emigrants to Israel, but American-based American Jews? What attitude towards Yiddish have they tended to favor, and has that, or have those attitudes changed over the years also?
Well, I think there are a couple of different attitudes. I don't think there's just one, but for instance, in my own family, my father spoke Yiddish. He was very proud to be able to speak Yiddish, but it was a secret language, one that he only spoke among close friends and family. He didn't wish to transmit it to us because also it was the language of poverty. It was the language of, again, of a kind of humiliating experience. And he wanted to be an American. My and today, of course, a lot of people look upon Yiddish with great nostalgia and sentimentality. But the thing is that in the European context of the 1900s, early 1900s, YIVO was a language among languages. Kant was translated into Yiddish. Freud was translated into Yiddish. Even Husserl, the great phenomenologist, was translated into Yiddish. It was a real language of commerce, of daily life. You would brush your teeth with Yiddish. You would take out the trash with Yiddish. And unfortunately, that large, multidimensional aspect of the language is all but gone today.
According to a recent survey, you know about this survey by the Pew organization,
yes.
Among the other interesting things that they disclosed there, it turns out that only about 5% of American Jews, 5% of non-Orthodox American Jews have mm-hmm. any comfort with the language at all. But of course, mm-hmm. the Orthodox, particularly the Hasidim, use it as truly their mamaloshen, their mother tongue.
That's correct. They do because they can't use Yiddish for that. And one of the things that's happening.
You mean they can't use Hebrew for that?
I'm sorry, they can't use Hebrew for that.
Because that would be that would be sacrilegious to use Hebrew as a secular language the way it is done, the way it is used in Israel.
That's correct. But what the Hasidim are doing is also introducing a lot of American vernacular into Yiddish.
Uh-huh.
And so they're actually changing the language.
Well, that has happened. That happens to all languages, particularly as they rove around the world. And Yiddish, of course, has been acquiring vocabularies from just about every conceivable language other than the Asian ones. Its base, of course, is in Middle High German, so-called. But even while the Ashkenazic Jews are still there in Germany in the 10th and 11th centuries. Already mm-hmm. you've got a lot of, apart from German, you've got a lot of French and Italian drifting
right.
into the language.
There's French, Swedish. Obviously, there's a lot of Slavic.
Particularly later on as the Jews move east into the
yes.
what ultimately becomes the Pale of Settlement.
That's correct. Probably 12th, 13th century and so forth. Whereas the language begins earlier than that.
Yeah.
The word shmata, for instance, which all Jews know this word, and many non-Jews know this word.
Well, it means originally rag, but it's used in the garment industry in New York, where they speak of producing shmata or shmati.
Shmata, exactly. Yeah. And many, many American Jews made their fortunes on the shmata business.
Yeah.
It turns out that shmata is a Polish word.
Sure.
So you see, the language itself is in a way a representation of the history of the people in their interactions with their neighbors.
Of course, also there's a vast amount or a considerable amount of Hebrew-derived words in spoken Yiddish, and that naturally would be a major source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a wonderful language. It's a very colorful language precisely for this reason. And in this respect, it's a little bit like English, which is a combination of Latinate and Germanic languages. And the consequence of that is that English has many different levels of texture and nuance from the interconnection of these languages. And Yiddish actually is very much like it, depending upon if you wish to use a Hebrew word or a Slavic word or a German word. It conveys different, it has different connotations.
Lots of secular Jews are still very involved in acquiring Yiddish. Some of them learn it later in life. Somebody I know here in Chicago, he used to be the head of YIVO in the YIVO branch in Chicago, is Jeffrey Mallow. Is he still running the group here?
I don't know if Jeffrey is running the group in Chicago. I think it's Jake Morowitz.
Uh-huh. But Jeffrey told me some years ago that, and he speaks a very full, fluent Yiddish, that he acquired it as an adult. He decided he would go learn Yiddish, and he did. So there is that, but mostly it flourishes among the Orthodox. However, in that regard, one has to begin to take into account this very interesting and to many rather disturbing study done by the Pew Group and reported only a few weeks ago. Very few non-Orthodox still speak Yiddish in terms of sheer numerosity, so to speak. What's more interesting in that study as reported, it was a survey done with good survey technology or survey methodology. I read just a paragraph or two. The intermarriage rate, a bellwether statistic, has reached a high of 58% for all Jews and 71% for non-Orthodox Jews, a huge change from before 1970 when only 17% of Jews married outside the faith. That's the stunning finding, which is bothering lots of official Jews, people in Jewish organizations. What does YIVO have to say about that?
Well, YIVO, as an organization, does not have a position on this. I know that any number of people within the organization are confused or worried about the Pew survey. I myself am not worried about it. I think the Jewish people is a very strong people. I don't think that our strength comes from numbers. If it came from numbers, we would have been a lot stronger in 1939 than we are today, but we weren't very strong in 1939. I don't think that our strength comes from necessarily adhering to a certain set of rituals. I think our strength comes from self-knowledge and from an understanding of history and a concentrating, as the Talmud says, on what is essential as opposed to what is superficial in life. And to be honest, intermarriage has been a fact of Jewish life from the very beginning of time. Moses left Egypt with what is described in the Bible as a mixed multitude. He marries a Midianite girl. It is from the beginning of time the fate of the Jews to have this kind of interaction with their neighbors. And I am optimistic about the future, provided that the Jewish people retain a desire for knowledge and a desire to pass knowledge onto their children. What form that knowledge takes, I don't know. But I think that one of the things that Evo can add to this whole conversation is a better understanding of what the Jewish people of Eastern Europe actually were. We talk about Jewish identity today. We don't even know what Jewish identity is. Some people are describing it as a religion. Some people describe it as an ethnicity. But what does that mean, an ethnicity, that I'm descended from a King David? That doesn't make any sense. Who was King David descended from? It makes absolutely no sense. And there are genealogical studies that show that there is no such thing as Jewish DNA. Yes, there are some markers that come from the Middle East, but the Jews have always been a people that have absorbed and have transmitted to a larger population and from a larger population.
Chris, there are some interesting DNA studies. In fact, I remember one that was reported a few years ago that seemed to have a fair amount of scientific verisimilitude about it, that the other group in the world to whom Ashkenazic as well as Sephardic Jews seem to be most closely related in terms of DNA parallels are contemporary Palestinians.
Yes. Right, exactly. But
those guys really are our cousins.
Indeed. I think that people, there are all kinds of myths about who we are, how we develop as a people. And these are the kinds of myths that the Evo Institute is particularly set up to analyze and to assess and to show. In fact, let me give you one little example of this.
Yes, please.
We have in our archives something called the Pincus of Metz. It is a record of the rabbinical court of the city of Metz in 1771 to 1790, that is before the French Revolution. And in this document that is many, many hundreds of pages long and written in Hebrew are all of the court cases that came before the rabbis. And among these court cases are any number which demonstrate the close interrelationship between Jews and non-Jews. They represent the role of women in ways that defy the received wisdom of our tradition about women. And moreover, this court records the desire of the Jewish court to find ways of coming more into accord with the French court. And it seemed to be under absolutely no pressure to do so from the outside, from the king, from officialdom, from anything. It's very, very fascinating. And it shows that there was always much more of a permeable membrane between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community. And if you go back in the records, you find among many of the documents written by Jews in the late 19th century, encomia about their life in Poland and in Lithuania. What a wonderful world it is. Why they have flourished as they have in those lands. And of course, a lot of that flourishing meant living with the non-Jewish populations. It meant often conversion one way or the other. So, Jewish life is a civilization. We are a civilization. We're not just numbers. And we're still a flourishing civilization and a very strong one.
So, yes, of course. And indeed, there are whole movements. The Reconstructionist movement, for example, essentially defines Jewish defines Jewishness as membership in and participation in a particular civilization. But if you look at the American Jewish scene, and we are, after all, the second most numerous group of Jews in the world. I guess by now Israel certainly does surpass us. But if you look at the American scene, if I just look at my Jewish friends, they're not very different from my non-Jewish friends, except for a certain vestigial interest, perhaps, or concern about Israel, though some of them on the leftist side are virtually anti-Zionist, which is also a matter of some bother. But beyond that, what they all share, if they're second or third generation in this country, so to speak, is what one might be labeled nostalgic gustatory ideation. That is to say, the lox and bagels culture, which is also indulged in Hillel organizations on every American campus on Sunday morning, as a way of bringing the Jewish kids in to try to Hillelize them. In other words, what I'm really saying is that for non-Orthodox and even for some Reform Jews, Jewishness has faded in terms of its real cultural meaning, except for little holdovers that have some momentary nostalgic pleasure to them.
Well, I think, unfortunately, that's the case. Bagel and cream cheese and lox, you can't build a civilization on that, although that could represent a civilization. But you can't build it on that. You can't build a civilization on nostalgia. You can't build a civilization on sentimentality. You know, you're absolutely right. If that's all there is, it's going to disappear. And that may not be the worst thing in the world. You know?
Don't you have to see the intermarriage rate, which now for non-Orthodox Jews, as I was just saying, runs up 70%. Don't you see that as an augury of a coming fading away of Jewishness in America?
Well, I don't know what to say about that exactly, because I'm not sure I even know what Jewishness itself means.
Uh-huh.
And you see, I think, I really believe that Jewishness, Judaism, what it means to be a Jew is something that we have to give much more attention to, and not just, you know, just walking around with in a black hat and a black coat and performing the rituals. I'm not sure what that means for you and me and the vast majority of American Jews who are really identified in a secular world. What is it that we are trying to perpetuate? Are we trying to perpetuate to our children? Are we trying to give our children a set of rituals that differentiate them from other people just for the sake of differentiating them from other people?
You know, this very question gives me an opportunity or the occasion to switch to something else that I certainly should be getting you to talk about. An earlier phase in your career, which produced a very interesting and rich set of new experiences for you. I refer, of course, to your position at Yale University Press, which began, what, in 1990? Do I remember that correctly?
That's right, 1991, actually.
Yeah, and as editorial director. And in that regard, you started a great new series, particularly once the in the post-Stalin period, in the post-Brezhnev period, when Yeltsin ordered that all the archives could be opened. And you rushed in there, made some wonderful connections, and started a project to get a lot of different scholars working in those archives. Archives, again, Russian, the communist archives rather than Jewish East European archives. But one question that arose at that time is, this relates back to the question of assimilation and the way in which Jewishness gets transformed, is what was the status of Soviet Jews during those years? Did they lose their Jewishness? And why? And are some of them now trying to recover, or many of them trying to recover it, and how are they doing with all of that? What's the picture of Soviet Jewish life as it was during the Stalin years and beyond, down to the present moment?
Well, you know, one of the great attractions of the Soviet Union after the revolution was that it allowed Jews to flourish as a people. and Yiddish was encouraged. So many Jewish writers flocked back to the Soviet Union, like David Bergelson and Peretz Markish and people of that sort. And Isaac Babel was there and so forth. And Jewish life flourished. Then comes 1929, 1930, and Stalin seizes power, and slowly but surely all national literatures and languages start being restricted and brought under Soviet domination until the beginning of World War II, when, because of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, Stalin began to start looking at Jews as Jews. And all of a sudden in 1939, 1940, various leading Jewish intellectuals like Babel and Koltsov and others are arrested and shot. Meyerhold, the great theater director, is arrested because his name made the Soviet authorities think he was Jewish. He wasn't. He was a German. In any case, a certain amount of anti-Semitism that was latent in the Russian world is being brought back to the surface, unfortunately, partly as a result of that pact with Hitler, because I believe, and other scholars believe, that Stalin wanted to show Hitler, at least at the outset, that he too will be tough on the Jews. But unfortunately, once he let that out of the bag, it began to draw on all kinds of anti-Semitic feelings in the Ukrainian world, in the Russian world. And by the end of the war, there was a great deal of built-up anti-Semitism in the country. And Stalin takes advantage of this, particularly once the State of Israel is formed. And he begins to think that the Jews who remain in Russia are more loyal to Israel than they are to the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And he begins the great anti-Jewish, anti-cosmopolitan campaign.
In fact, that is covered very interestingly and in a very revealing way in the first major book that you did, titled Stalin's Last Crime.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, this, fortunately, Stalin dies in 1953 before whatever it is he was planning for the Jews could really take effect. But it was very clear from a lot of the indications that there was going to be a big purge of Jews in the Soviet Union, that he had built four new concentration camps in the Far East. And it's quite likely that Jews were going to be deported from the cities. What their fate would have been, what is probably not gas chambers, but probably hard labor, probably a total decimation of Jewish culture.
But is it not the case that apart from some survivals of Orthodoxy, in the main, Soviet Jewry lost much of its Jewishness? Among other things, lost the Yiddish language.
Yeah. However, I should tell you, I just came back from Kiev, and to my delight and surprise, people at the conference came up to me and were speaking Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
That was their first language. That was the language I could communicate with them in.
Really?
And that's to say, they would speak Yiddish to me and I would speak Russian to them. But clearly it survives in pockets. And it is being revived as a language by various efforts in Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, and Germany today, and Russia.
I've moved you in the direction of work you did before you went to Evo, namely that great Annals of Communism series that you edited while at Yale. How many books did that finally produce? Over 20, I know.
It close to 30, actually.
30. And yeah, you report on that in another book that you yourself did titled Inside the Stalin Archives. Is that the – do I have that title?
Right. Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my account of going to the archives and starting the series and basically what I learned.
Isn't it interesting? Of course, you know the parallel, and probably many have commented upon it to you, that job of yours was focused on opening an archive and reviving and restoring it, and now you're doing the same with a very different but very important other archive.
Well, I'll tell you, it gave me a great appreciation for the value of these archives,
yeah.
And because what we've learned about the Soviet system, again, has overturned numerous stereotypes and shibboleths and a lot of received wisdom about the Soviet regime and how it functioned and so on and so forth. And I believe that the EVO archives will do the same. And we're trying to do that with new educational programs, new publishing programs. We're trying to digitize all of our materials to make the documents as widely available to scholars as we possibly can. And the reason for my visits to Vilnius now are that we have started a project with the Lithuanian government to digitize all of the materials that are still in Lithuania and unite them with the materials we have here in the United States in a virtual archive.
Yes, I read a piece of yours just recently about one of your visits to Vilna and about the woman who's really running that whole operation there. It was very moving, actually, of the description of how much was lost and how few people there are around who even know of the archive in Vilnius.
Yeah. It's a sad situation. There are about 100,000 pages of documentation there. We're not even sure the total amount. And there are maybe 8,000 to 10,000 books, very important books, that will stay in Lithuania, but we need to digitize them. There really are no people left in Lithuania who can read this material.
Another interest of yours, of course, is reflected in the work that has been done at EVO and now is, I gather, sort of reinvigorated, and that is a direct interest in Yiddish literature, high literature, of Sholem Aleichem, best known of all, but there are so many others. You know, it's very funny. I must tell you, again, getting personal for a moment, in some of your materials, as I pulled them off the internet just in the last few days, I saw a picture of five or six writers in Yiddish in Russia before the revolution sitting there. And one of them was a man named Avrom Rezin. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid in New York going to the Sholem Aleichem Volksschule, which was an after-school school in which one studied Yiddish and did Yiddish-oriented things, we read a children's book titled Jingle Ringele, which was written by Avrom Rezin. And my father then told me, you once sat on his lap. It turns out that when I was about 3 years old, he visited our home. He was in America by then, obviously. I guess he was a member of the Arbeiterverband or something, which my father was also a member of. There suddenly, in a picture taken back in 1910 or something, is a man on whose lap I once sat, though I don't remember it, but whose children's book, written in Yiddish, I tremendously enjoyed.
Oh, that's a wonderful story, Milt. And it shows the linkage between this world and that world. It's a living linkage still to this day. And, of course, Avram Raisin's brother, Zalman, was in Vilna and one of the founding members of the EVO Institute.
Yeah. You made a particularly, there's something particularly touching in something you encountered recently as you're doing your research on Isaac Babel. We should say a word about who Babel was and then that picture that you saw, which you describe in something I read recently. The picture being the one outside synagogue in which possibly one of the dead bodies piled up possibly a member of your family.
Yeah, that's correct. Isaac Babel was a Jewish writer born in Odessa in 1884. And he became one of the great writers in the Soviet Union, and I think today is still regarded as one of the great 20th century writers in any language. He was fluent in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in German, in French, in Russian, of course. He probably spoke a little English and Polish. He was an amazing human being who studied Torah and Talmud as a child. And but he chose to write in Russian. He wrote his most famous stories are the ones he wrote about Odessa, called the Odessa Stories, and of course his account of being with the Red Cavalry in Ukraine in the 1920s. The story, the picture that you referred to, Milt, is one that we have in our archive at EVO. And the way I found it is that I was doing some research on Isaac Babel's diary of 1920, where he, the diary begins in Zhytomyr, which is where my family was from. And so I asked, I went to EVO, this was back in 1993 or 94, I came to EVO in New York and I said, do you have any photographs of Zhytomyr around 1920? Because we were going to publish Babel's diary. And I wanted to see if there were any photographs there. And they said, no, but we have some other photographs earlier. And I said, well, bring them out. You know, I'd like to see them. And sure enough, they bring out a photograph from 1903 pogrom. Mm-hmm. And the first victim of the pogrom was a member of my family.
Ah.
So.
And you see, in the picture are bodies stacked up, I gather, around a synagogue. Mm-hmm. And you conjecture one of them is probably your relative.
Well, there's a picture of him. His name was Yankel Brodsky.
Ah, you have all the detail, yeah.
Yeah, and my family's name was Brodsky, and they were from Zhytomyr, and certainly this man was a member of our family. And my grandfather emigrates the year following and comes to America. And probably it had something to do with this pogrom.
Hmm. It's a rich career you've had and are continuing in the work at EVO. Tell me, in the time we've got left, which is about 5 minutes, what you're really up to with EVO right now, what the situation is there, what your ambitions are, what's going on.
Okay, well, we are in the process of building a variety of programs. One of them, of course, is to digitize and make available to as wide a public as we possibly can all of our archival and library assets. I think it's essential that we do this. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is raise money in that effort. We believe that the work in Lithuania to reconnect what we have with what's in Lithuania is going to be close to $500,000 project. And so it's a substantial initiative on our part. But in conjunction with this, we are building educational programs because even though we live here in the United States and we all assume that we already know everything that happened in history to the Jewish people and that this story has been written, the fact is it has not been written. And the fact is that if you go to almost any university program in America, what you'll find is that although many have very extensive Jewish studies programs, very few have programs devoted to Eastern Europe, which is where the Jews lived for 1,000 years, the longest period of life outside of Israel, anywhere in the world, including in Spain. And so this is a huge and substantial component of a contemporary Jewish experience about which we know almost nothing. We just don't know how people lived. We don't know what their relations with the outside world were. We don't know what they thought and felt, where their music came from, where their folklore came from. And so I'm in the process of developing visiting professorships to YIVO. We are fortunate to have gotten the funding for one on the subject of East European Jewish history, but I am trying to establish similar visiting professorships in music, in literature, in art, in Yiddish language and linguistics, because the Yiddish language still requires more analysis and study and scholarship. All of these things, I think, are not just dead academic subjects, but they're essential for the Jewish community in the diaspora, of which America is now the largest diaspora, Jewish diaspora, of course. It's essential for us to know these things, because when the Pew Report came out, what the Pew Report was talking about was largely Jews of East European descent in America. What is happening to that population? And one of the things that is very clear is that the conflicts and the turmoil in the Jewish community in Poland and Lithuania and Russia and so forth, a lot of that came with the people to the United States. These issues that we're confronting today, they didn't just start in 1960 or the year 2000 or in 1909. They started in 1800. They started in 1850. It has to do with a much broader understanding of what Jewish history in the 20th century and now in the 21st really is all about.
And in earlier periods, even in this country and certainly in Eastern Europe, it also had to do with the question of whether one wanted to be in full connection with the outer, larger culture, which was the host culture, whether it was Russian or Belarusian or Polish or Ukrainian, and inner Jewish life. There were those who always argued against assimilation, though the general trend was toward assimilation wherever it was permitted or encouraged.
That's absolutely so. And I mean, this is why you mentioned Shimon Dubnov earlier. He is such a great figure in the Jewish world, and he deserves more study, because his writings on these subjects, on Jewish nationalism, starting in 1893, these are very important for understanding a lot of the issues that American Jews are facing today. We somehow came to the conclusion that with the establishment of the State of Israel, all of these historical problems were brought to an end. But that is not true. And even Israel today is recognizing that its younger generations are seeking some kind of connection to the East European world that so many of them came from.
I know that you are, among other things, a great reader of Sholem Aleichem. I think a title of one of his stories in its Yiddish is Sistaka Shveil Tzazayna Yid. It's really hard to be a Jew. It seems to me that what you're saying now, and I agree with you, to put it in Yiddish again, Sistaka Interessant Tzazayna Yid. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I believe that Sholem Aleichem was fully aware of these issues. And that's why I'm teaching a course myself in January called The Other Sholem Aleichem, which is an attempt at showing how many of his works, particularly his later works, are keenly aware of the complex relationship that Jews have to the world they live in. And I think that's the main thing that I want to try to project through what we do at EVO, that we are not a self-enclosed entity. We have always had these very interesting relationships with the outside. Well, let me give you one small example of this. If you go to Wikipedia and you type in Sigmund Freud, what you'll find is that he is an Austrian physician in living in Vienna, who started psychoanalysis. The truth is, Sigmund Freud is the offspring of Galician Jews who had migrated from Galicia to Moravia. He went home and spoke Yiddish to his family, to his mother. We know this because Yiddish was the only language she could speak. And think of the contribution that this Galician family that had moved to Vienna has made in the world. And there are so many examples of this,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the Jewish contribution to world civilization is vast, and it's vaster than people usually want to recognize. And a lot of that comes from Eastern Europe.
In modern painting, one great contributor was Lucian Freud, who died only a year or two ago. I think he was the direct grandson of Sigmund.
That's right. That's right. And, I mean, we could multiply these examples almost endlessly.
You know, I must, we're almost out of time, but I must note one very particular paradox, which I'm sure you've dealt with, you've talked about with many others who've noted it as well. You mentioned your teaching just now. You have for some time been a part-time faculty member at Bard College, up a little ways from New York City in New York State. And what the great paradox, of course, is that you hold the Alger Hiss Memorial Chair in literature and whatever. You, if anyone, have kind of given the final quietus to those who argue that Alger Hiss was actually innocent and was persecuted in that trial. One of the books you published, the one by Harvey Clare and so on, makes very clear that he was an agent of the Comintern, or an agent of the communist, of the Russian communist operation, and had been from way back in early New Deal days. How do you handle that particular paradox?
Well, my nose is often rubbed in it, but let me tell you what happened.
Yeah.
Leon Botstein, president of Bard College, offered this position to me, and I said, Leon, you know, I've done about more than anybody else recently to prove that Alger Hiss was a spy. I don't think the family is going to want me in that position. So he talked to Tony Hiss, Alger's son,
yeah.
And Tony Hiss said, well, I don't see any problem with that. I don't see any problem with someone holding that chair who believes that Alger Hiss was a spy. And so on that basis, I thought, well, if I'm going to be able to continue the work that I do and not feel under any pressure to modify my views on the subject or the work that I'm doing, I don't see why I shouldn't accept that position. And so I did, and I've been in that position now for almost 10 years,
yeah.
Where I teach Russian and Soviet history and Russian-Soviet literature, and also a course on the Jewish avant-garde.
It's been a delight talking with you, and of course it's a continuation of a long conversation we've held over the years. I gather you're going to be coming to Chicago to, indeed, a last question, a PSPS kind of question. There is a YIVO group, I mentioned earlier, in Chicago. There are various others around the country, I believe. Is that right?
I think the Chicago group is unique, but there are other groups around the world. There is, for instance, a major YIVO connection in Buenos Aires.
Yeah, where there is a sizable Jewish population, of course.
Right. And you have to understand that when YIVO was founded, it was founded in Berlin, Warsaw, and Vilna.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the Vilna center became the leading center of YIVO activity. But nevertheless, it was a group in Berlin and a group in Warsaw also. Both of them were destroyed in the war.
Sure.
But YIVO was always envisioned to be an effort, a combined effort, that coordinated the work of many people in many different places. And so after the war, similar phenomena, manifestations of YIVO cropped up elsewhere in the United States and in the world. And we exist, but together, the New York Center is the mothership, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. No, we have to come to an end. So I'll end in Mamaloshen. Shenem Dank, and I hope to see you again soon.
Shenem Dank. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Now.